So with that, I am going we'll be starting the first lecture with David Spock, who is a professor of medicine at the University of Washington and an invaluable member of the AETC team.
Great, Laura, thank you very much. Well, first of all, welcome and thank you all for what you're doing in the field of HIV. I've been a longtime HIV care provider, and it's great to see people at this conference. And I, as a fellow HIV provider, really appreciate what everybody is doing. What I'm going to do today is to focus on some fundamentals related to the biology of HIV. It's kind of an introduction to this conference. First of all, I have no disclosure, no financial disclosures. And here are the actual learning objectives, the formal learning objectives. And then I'll really get into more of what I want you to walk away from in terms of an outline of what we're going to cover. So the three learning objectives are to summarize the events of early HIV infection, which is extremely important in the pathogenesis of HIV, then list the sequence of the laboratory markers following acquisition, which is really important understanding now why we're using combination antigen-antibody assays for routine HIV screening, and third, describe the basic mechanisms of antiretroviral therapy. And I think this is really probably the most important objective, as you're going to be hearing throughout this conference, loads and loads of information about antiretroviral drugs. It's good to kind of have a visual understanding of how these drugs work. Now, here's the outline of what I'm going to cover. This is going to be a little bit different talk in that it's not going to be a very data-driven talk. This is more of a conceptual talk. And again, it's more of an intro to the HIV. This is to help you understand a lot of the information that you're going to be hearing about throughout the conference. So I'm going to really cover four things. First of all, the pathogenesis of HIV transmission and focusing on sexual transmission of HIV and early infection, those initial events in the first 10 days of the infection. Then I'll talk about how do you diagnose and manage acute HIV and why that's so important. And then I'll talk about the natural history of HIV, and we've learned a lot that not everybody has the same natural history, and there's extremes of this, even elite controllers, and this comes up to be a very relevant clinical issue. And then last, I'll really focus on specific drug mechanisms related to understanding of the HIV life cycle. So let me go ahead and jump in with the pathogenesis of transmission and early infection. So when people are infected with HIV on a chronic basis, they have essentially a swarm or quasi-species of viruses that are inside their body. As you can see here, this individual has multiple different strains of HIV. And with a sexual exposure or sexual transmission and body fluid exchange, there may be multiple different viruses that get passed to the other person in a genital exchange or in terms of a secretion exchange. But what actually happens in terms of transmission, even though there are multiple viruses that may encounter the mucosal surfaces, there's usually only one, maybe two, that actually end up causing the transmission. And we call the virus that does this founder virus. And this is really very important as you think about prevention strategies and understanding that not all viruses are capable of transmitting HIV. There's certain very sort of unique viruses that have qualities and characteristics that make them fit to cause the transmission event. Now, if you look down more sort of at the genital mucosal level and think about it in this way, you can see that there's sort of multiple different types of HIV as represented by different colors of the strains of the quasi-species. But you can see there's one kind of in the middle there, the blue one, that made the event happen in terms of transmission. And this is called the prime infection, and this is showing you sort of what happens very early on day one. So there's usually the initial cell is a CD4 cell, but it can be tissue macrophages and other cells that are infected. But usually it's a CD4 cell. And the virus that transmits is usually what we call a very replication-competent R5 tropic HIV. So for those of you that do more advanced care and you know about Maraviroc and CCR5 inhibitors, the concept, this is familiar to you, but for those of you that aren't familiar with this concept of R5 tropic virus, this is a schematic showing you that as HIV approaches a cell, the first thing that encounters on the surface of a CD4 cell is a CD4 receptor. That's the step number one in terms of viral entry. And the next are one of these co-receptors. And the most common co-receptors that the virus would encounter is CCR5 or CXCR4. So when we talk about a R5 tropic virus, what we're talking about is the virus has unique characteristics on its envelope that preferentially make it use one of these co-receptors. So the R5 tropic, or R5 virus in short, preferentially binds to and enters the cell through the CCR5 pathway. So at the time of acute HIV, it's almost always an R5 tropic strain that is involved with the transmission of HIV. Now moving on sort of from a day by day, what happens after this day one prime infection? Days 2 to 4 are really characterized by local HIV expansion in CD4 cells. And this tends to accelerate as you get some of these CD4 cells becoming activated. And then the actual proliferation of the virus can start to be more robust within a couple of days. So that's very early, now within still the first 5 days, and this is called local HIV expansion. Then the next thing that happens, and this is where things really start to accelerate, some of the other cells in the tissues shown here by the dendritic cells, which are these green cells, can actually accelerate the process by transmitting the virus into the lymph nodes, and the virus can get there on its own, but the dendritic cells really accelerate this process. And once the virus gets in the lymph nodes, you have a much more sort of rapid ramp up of everything that's happened in these early events. And this is called regional lymphatic dissemination, and this is typically occurring in days 3 to 7 after infection. Now, on days 7 to 10, the virus starts to really spill over from the lymph nodes, make its way into the systemic circulation, and now you have replicating virus that's circulating throughout the body. And that tends to occur around day 7 to 10, and I'll show you in a minute, typically about day 10 is when you can start to detect the virus in the blood using commercially available assays. So we call this early hematogenous spread. So remember that these individuals up to day 10, using our laboratory assays and our conventional assays, we wouldn't actually know they had HIV, but there is virus that's already starting to proliferate in lymph nodes and now spread throughout the blood system. So this is very important from a conceptual standpoint. Now, this is graphically showing you sort of the ramp up of the HIV RNA levels. This graphic is showing you viral load in an individual who's acquired HIV, and you can see that at about day 10 is where you actually start to detect the virus. That period from infection till you can detect it is called the eclipse phase. And that's very important because those individuals theoretically could transmit HIV very late in that eclipse phase, but you would not detect it even with our commercially available assays. Research assays, potentially yes, or tissue biopsies, potentially yes, that you would in lymph nodes. But with conventional assays, this eclipse phase, you would not detect HIV. Now, with this early dissemination, there's something very profound that happens early in the gut. So part of the initial dissemination involves dissemination to the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. You will hear this term GALT, that is gut-associated lymphoid tissue. On the left-hand side, you can see a rendition, a drawing of more normal gut-associated lymphoid tissue, which is really filled with a number of CD4 cells, CD8 cells, dendritic cells, and many, many other cells as well, too, the gastrointestinal cells. But this is from an immune standpoint. Now, looking over to the right, after initial HIV infection, there is rapid and profound depletion of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. And much of this is permanent in that individuals who acquire HIV often never completely restore this damage that occurs in the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. From a pathogenesis standpoint that I'll discuss later, when we talk about chronic inflammation, this particular fallout that occurs very early is integrally tied in with what happens later with chronic inflammation and chronic immune activation in people with HIV. Now, let me move to the diagnosis and management of HIV infection in the early phase and in the acute phase. So here's the challenge. This is a summary of some data of individuals who have acute HIV. Here are the symptoms: fever, lethargy, myalgias, rash, headache. That could be anything. Could be the flu, could be mono, could be a bunch of different things. So the challenge for clinicians is that acute HIV is often a nonspecific illness, and often approximately 50% of people don't even present to medical care because it's so nonspecific they don't think they have a severe illness. Some people can be severely ill, but again, the challenge for the clinicians is great because if you don't know they recently had that exposure, you may not even think about acute HIV in your differential diagnosis. So nonspecific symptoms, the takeaway point is a flu-like illness or mononucleosis-like illness. Now, the other challenge is that if you are only using conventional HIV antibody testing, at the time that someone presents with HIV, they are in what we call the seroconversion window period, as shown here graphically. So I said that about day 10 is when the viral load pops up, but it's not till about day 25 or so in that range that you actually start to detect antibodies using conventional third-generation antibody assays. So if you're not suspecting it or you think about it and you only order an antibody test, you will miss the diagnosis of acute HIV. So this is showing you sort of where the dilemma is and what might be more useful. So in the acute illness with acute HIV, individuals fall in the zone here where you can see they have a clearly detectable HIV RNA level. And let me emphasize, when people have acute HIV, they often have sky-high viral loads. So if you get a viral load back and it's 55 and they're presenting with a flu-like illness, that I can almost guarantee you that's not going to be acute HIV. They typically have very high viral loads when they're presenting with clinical symptoms. So see there that you've got a viral load that's detectable, an antibody that has not been detectable yet. Now, one thing that has helped us is the green line in the middle. This is the P24 antigen test. So if you're routinely ordering HIV testing now, your laboratory, hopefully, is using a fourth-generation antigen-antibody combination assay. And one of the reasons that the CDC and national sort of leaders recommended moving to a fourth-generation antigen-antibody test is right here on this graphic. You can see that the P24 antigen detects people with very early HIV approximately a week to 10 days before conventional antibody. But notice, though, it's not as sensitive at detecting HIV as the viral load or the HIV RNA. So it is very good for acute HIV, but not as good as detecting with an HIV RNA assay. So using conventional testing, and most, again, hopefully most people are using initial testing with HIV antigen antibody assays. So here's the sort of typical pattern you would get. Your screening test in someone with acute HIV with HIV antigen antibody should be positive. The test will usually trip because of the P24 antigen. But actually, the way that the assay is run, it just turns color, and you don't know why it tripped. You just know it tripped. But it is usually tripping in this situation positive because of the P24 antigen. Now, because they haven't developed antibodies yet, when you go to do the next step, the reflex HIV-1-2 antibody differentiation assay, that test will be negative typically. But then, if that happens, you're supposed to do a viral load or HIV nucleic acid test. That test then should be positive. So this is a classic pattern. If you ever see, put it in the back of your mind to go, this person probably has acute HIV. Positive initial screening test, negative antibody, positive viral load or nucleic acid test. That's the classic for someone with very early or acute HIV. Here's a graphic that gives you a little bit better sort of sense of when all of these different types of assays turn positive. So again, about day 10, the blue bar here is when the HIV RNA, that eclipse period, it happens at up from time of infection to about day 10. And then notice the next thing that typically turns positive is the P24 antigen, and this is usually in the fourth generation antigen antibody assay. But notice here that if you are using one of the point of care rapid tests for fourth generations, it is not as sensitive, and it's delayed by 3 or 4 days compared to the laboratory-based sort of typical fourth-generation combination assay. If you look at third-generation assays, typical sort of older antibody tests that we've used, you can see they're going to be delayed. It's going to be somewhere after day 20, around day 23, 25, somewhere in this range. But if you're using one of the rapid tests, point of care tests like an OraQuick test, notice those are really significantly delayed all the way out to about day 30 or 32. And many people have made this point that you are going to miss a significant number of people with early, very early HIV if you're using OraQuick as your only screening tool for people for making a diagnosis of HIV. And notice the test that we really use very little now, the Western blot, is really very poor at detecting people with very early HIV. Okay, now, here's an unusual situation, but I do want to bring it up. You can occasionally see people who are very, very early with HIV where their antigen, P24 antigen, has not reached high enough levels, or they just have a low enough level that the laboratory assay is not picking it up. So if you see someone and they've got a recent exposure to HIV and they have classic acute HIV symptoms, and their initial screening test is negative, don't give up there. You could do one of two things. You could repeat it again a couple weeks. But if you really suspect acute HIV, this is the one circumstance where you should order directly an HIV RNA assay, even with no other evidence that the person has a laboratory diagnosis of HIV. And especially if you think there may be low chances of follow-up to come back for the follow-up testing in several weeks. And again, this is not a common situation, but it can arise. High suspicion, negative initial test, you can do a viral load test. And again, the viral load test should be strongly positive if they really have acute HIV. And one of the reasons that I'm focusing on acute HIV is the consequences of making the diagnosis are very, very high. High for that individual, high for the community. These individuals are considered at significant transmission risk for several different reasons. First of all, they just got HIV and they are not aware of their status of HIV if you've not made the diagnosis. Secondly, I've said several times they have very high viral loads. They also have very high levels of HIV RNA in their genital secretions as well. Third, they have not had a good antibody response to their infection, so they have what we call low titers of neutralizing antibodies. And last, from a conceptual standpoint, if you look over at the individual here, and you look at sort of the idea of their population of viruses that they have, if they're early in their infection, they're starting to develop some new clones and new quasi-species of HIV, but very early, what they predominantly have are this transmission-capable HIV, the founder virus, the most capable virus that causes transmission. This is sort of your super transmitter virus that now they're loaded up with early in their infection. So we don't know enough about this from a pathogenesis standpoint, but a lot of experts believe this is a very highly vulnerable time in terms of high rates, high likelihood of HIV transmission. And the risk is much greater than with people who have chronic infection. The second reason that this is very important for clinicians to make this diagnosis is that this is an ideal time to make sure that you're doing partner notification. It's extremely important. They just had a recent contact, so it's going to be within the last 2 to 3 weeks. So if someone has an exposure to the time they develop symptoms, I've said it's going to be several weeks. So, you know, it's not like you're going to have to go back too far to figure this out. You should be able to find their recent contacts with a high likelihood that someone had HIV. In addition, if you are diagnosing them and they've continued to have sexual activity with acute HIV, forward transmission is very likely, so you need to be doing partner notification in that regard. So I would say this circumstance, more than any, is extremely high priority for partner notification. Now, what about treatment of these individuals? Treatment of these individuals, there's an urgency to treat for three reasons. There's to minimize the immune damage, second, to limit the infection of the latent reservoir pool, and third, to prevent high-risk forward transmission of HIV. So treatment is beneficial for the individual, and it's and very important also for the community as large. And you're going to hear a talk later about cure of HIV, and we believe that if you could limit the reservoir that gets set up at the very beginning, it may make it more feasible for people to be cured down the road. So here's a question for you. So a 23-year-old man is diagnosed with acute HIV with an HIV RNA level of 324,000. An HIV genotypic drug resistance test is ordered. The decision is made to start treatment now. So the question is, acute HIV, so internet connection loss, so somewhat, see if that still works. Nope. Okay, we'll skip that. Okay, so the question was this. So let me just go over it real quick. So the question is, what do you treat people with? So here's the concept. If you diagnose someone with acute HIV, number one, don't wait. These are individuals you do not want to say, okay, we'll see you back in 2 or 3 months and start antiretroviral therapy. You either want to try and start treatment that day or certainly within a 1 week period. That's where I think the field has gone to. Very urgent setting to try and get these individuals on antiretroviral treatment. Second thing is, what should you use? Well, you're not going to have time to get your genotypic drug resistance test back. You should definitely order it before you give them any medication. But you're not going to have the drug resistance test back. So you need to use a regimen that you have high confidence that will work even if the person has some resistance. So you use the drugs at the highest tier of genetic barrier resistance. You'll hear more about in this in the conference. So that would really be in the guidelines, in the HHS guidelines, what they recommend in this setting is either dolutegravir or boosted darunavir. So I would, as your anchor drug. So I would say that in that setting, also bictegravir will probably move into the guidelines as a recommended drug in this setting as well, too. Now, the backbone should also have a higher genetic barrier resistance, so it's recommended to use a tenofovir-based backbone. So tenofovir, the old tenofovir, tenofovir DF, or the new tenofovir, tenofovir alafenamide, combined in a fixed drug combination with M-tricitabine. So TAF-FTC, TDF-FTC, plus this high-potent, high genetic barrier resistance anchor drug, dolutegravir or boosted darunavir. And the point of this is, as well, is that they do not recommend using abacavir lamivudine in this backbone because the genetic barrier resistance is not quite as high. Okay, now let me move briefly into what happens after infection. There is the set point that occurs typically about 30 to 50 days after the initial event. So this is the point where the immune system kicks in and starts to control the virus. Now, we know that people have different set points, and the idea is that certain people have a more exact and precise CTL, or cytotoxic T lymphocyte response. When that happens, their viral load is shown in this graph. The blue goes down, and they tend to have a very slow progression of HIV. Those people up at the top that have a weaker CTL response have a more rapid progression. Now, this is just showing you sort of with the CD4 count, there's a more rapid progression in red, there's a moderate progression in the middle, and a slow progression. Again, this is based on the CTL cytotoxic T lymphocyte response. The take-home point is that if you don't treat HIV, people have very different progressions, and it's hard to predict. Now, the extreme of this is that there are individuals that are so-called viremic HIV controllers. So this is about 1 in 100 individuals that on their own, their viral loads are controlled by their immune system, keeping viral loads typically down in the very low level viremia, 50 to 200 copies on a regular basis. And then there are the elite controllers that have the very most precise and strong CTL responses to HIV. This is about 1 in 300 individuals. And again, on their own, they have very tight control of HIV down to the level usually at undetectable HIV RNA levels. They may intermittently become detectable, but these individuals are very tightly controlled. And if you look at this longitudinally with CD4 counts, this correlates very well that the viremic controllers typically have very slow CD4 count drops, and the elite controllers may even have little or no drop in their CD4 counts over a 5 or 10 year period, as shown in this graph here. And then now, what about just in terms of the natural sort of steady regular progression? This is just showing you one concept. This is without treatment. Typically, the CD4 count is going to relentlessly go down over in most people. And then the consequence of this that we all know about is immune deficiency, opportunistic infections, cancers, and everything. That's very clear, very well understood for a long, long period of time. In the past decade, it's become much more clear that throughout the course of HIV, there is problems that occur, and this is so-called immune activation and inflammation, and some of this may relate to that initial gut destruction that occurs and chronic exposure to a lot of bacterial pathogens and their products. So chronic immune activation and inflammation is a hallmark now of HIV pathogenesis, and the consequence of this is going to be an increased risk of myocardial infarction, stroke, and cancer. So for these reasons, you also now see a lot of enthusiasm for everybody being treated with HIV to prevent these complications. So now let me shift gears and talk about the HIV life cycle and the mechanisms of the drugs. And this is just a quick schematic just showing you that HIV basically has a goal to essentially use the cell, the host cell, and use all the essentially the elements of the host cell to take over the cell to make more viruses. And this is just a schematic showing you that it's a long, involved process with multiple steps. What I am going to do is take you through briefly the major classes of drugs and how they work. And notice that really there are five major classes, but I'm going to focus on the three that are most commonly used in clinical practice: the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, non-nucleosides, integrase inhibitors, and protease inhibitors. So you'll hear a lot during the conference about backbone drugs and anchor drugs. The backbone drugs are your nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. I'll go over that mechanism in a minute. The anchor drugs are the integrase inhibitors, the protease inhibitors, and the non-nucleosides. So these are the common drug classes that are used in clinical practice. I'm not going to talk about entry inhibitors since they're really only used sort of later in with resistance that once it occurs. So with HIV therapy, it's important to focus and understand that HIV has three key functional enzymes: reverse transcriptase, integrase, and protease. So they are excellent targets for our drug therapy, and that's really the three classes that I'm going to drill down on. So first of all, let's look at the reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So HIV has a fundamental goal that it's trying to do. It's trying to take its RNA and turn it into DNA, so the DNA can be stitched into the human cell, and then the human cell will take over and make more virus. That's its basic goal of what it's trying to do. And this process is called reverse transcription. And the enzyme that does this is called reverse transcriptase, and it's reverse because humans don't do this. We can't turn RNA into DNA. Our bodies are making DNA into RNA all day long, but not RNA to DNA. So that's where that term reverse transcription comes from. And basically what's happening is the virus takes its RNA, it has a strand that it starts adding on one by one, and it uses the human nucleotides. So it's using the human nucleotides to build on this. And there's a template strand that is sort of the base of it. And then there's a primer strand where the new nucleotides are being added on one by one. So template and primer are important from a conceptual standpoint. Now, what we try and do with our nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors is we use drugs that mimic and look very similar to normal human nucleotides to fool the virus. So the reverse transcriptase enzyme, it's a mobile enzyme that picks these up and essentially drops them down in the pocket in the polymerase site. It picks up one of the drugs, as shown here, one of the nucleoside reverse transcriptase, and if it picks it up, it is detrimental to the virus because this drug cannot have anything added onto it. It's like adding a caboose on to a train that you're building. So that's the effect, and we call this primer blocking because this is on the primer strand. The terminology that's often used is chain termination, and this is the so-called viral chain termination. So you'll hear this terminology used over and over again. For those of you that know about resistance, you'll hear about complicated concepts like primer unblocking and things. That's where all of that terminology comes from. Now, that's the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. They're decoy drugs. The non-nucleosides directly bind into the pocket. So there is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor binding pocket. And then there's a polymerase site that's right next to it that is a very active part for the enzyme reverse transcriptase. So when we use non-nucleoside drugs, what we're doing is that we're putting drugs that are going to go and they're essentially going to jam up this pocket. But really what they functionally do is they cause a hyperextension of the thumb region of the reverse transcriptase, and they alter the polymerase site as well. So they directly jam up the enzyme that is working. These are not decoy drugs. They're binding directly into the actual reverse transcriptase enzyme. So clearly different function than the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. Now let's move on to the integrase inhibitors and the integrase strand transfer inhibitors. The HIV integrase is a fascinating enzyme of the virus and exists in multiple different sort of formats. This is a dimer phase of it. It has three main components, but the business end of this is shown down sort of what looks like sort of the base of it. And there's a catalytic triad that are sort of three hot amino acids that are very importantly involved with divalent cations, specifically magnesium. They're involved in splicing open the human DNA. So that's the action site of the integrase enzyme. So interestingly, the integrase, once it's bound to the DNA, it essentially cuts off little snippets at the ends of the DNA. It primes the three prime end. It cuts off to make them sticky so they can essentially be melded into the human DNA. And this is showing you conceptually that the integrase makes its way into the nucleus, attached to the viral DNA, and then essentially finds these hot spots, and the integrase assist in opening these hot spots up, and then it assists essentially in the virus being able to weld the DNA into this. This is the process of integration and strand transfer, and then once that strand of the DNA is transferred into the human DNA, the integrase enzyme releases, the normal human enzymes smooth things over, and the virus doesn't, the human cell doesn't know it, but there is virus that is now on its hard drive, and this is called proviral HIV DNA. So if you hear proviral, that means virus that has been integrated in and stitched into human DNA. So the integrase strand transfer inhibitors are interesting. They actually, this is showing you schematically, they bind in that hot area, that catalytic triad. And they cause a couple of things to happen, but they're very efficient because inside of the cells, they actually only bind when the integrase enzyme is already complexed with the DNA. So they don't bind to loose integrase floating around in the cells. They're very efficient. And when they bind, they cause these magnesium hotspots to not be able to be opening up the host DNA. And so they several different mechanisms they use. But the idea is that once they're bound to the integrase enzyme, they are not then allowing this opening up and splicing up. And because they're blocking the transfer of this strand, these enzymes are called integrase strand transfer inhibitors. Now, I'm not going through multiple different things that the integrase does. There's many steps that I'm not showing you what they do. And there are multiple other ways in the future we may block integrase that will be called integrase inhibitors that may not be integrase strand transfer inhibitors. Let me finish by going over the last drug class to mention, which are the HIV protease inhibitors and this proteolytic processing. So once the virus makes proteins and polypeptides, they're like long strands of spaghetti that are not functional. You've got to chop them up into the right pieces. It's sort of like if you're going to build a log cabin, you just have one giant log. You've got to cut the pieces up all the time to the right dimensions and get it all to fit together. That's what this enzyme does. And this enzyme is in three different conformations, as you can see here. It has an open form, it has a semi-open form, and a closed form. And this is based on the upper area of the enzyme. And the virus is shaped very much like a V. I'm sorry, the enzyme shaped like a V. And it's a heterodimer, a mirror image of each other, the two elements of it. So the top flap region, when it closes, is shown here, clips or cleaves these polyproteins. And that's how it works. So now if you look at it just schematically, what's happening here, the idea is that there are these GAG polyproteins and GAG proteins that the virus is making. These are very important. These are the structural components of the virus, like matrix and capsid and so on. The enzymes are there. They need to be released, like reverse transcriptase and integrase. So the protease essentially frees them. It cuts them. And it does this in a very orderly and sequential fashion. As the virus is leaving and budding off from the cell, what happens is that the virus actually is in like a bicycle spoke-like mechanism, and as this is occurring and it's leaving and budding off from the cell, the protease is essentially revving up and making all these cuts. And then once all these cuts can be made, then the proteins can assemble, as shown here, in the functional way to form the virus. So the protease frees these protein and structural proteins and enzymes to form in that way. So the way the protease inhibitor works is that it jams right in the center of that pocket. So it prevents this sort of molecular cleaver from opening and closing and the flap from moving like it normally does. And by doing this, it essentially blocks these cleavages and leaves the virus in a immature or uncleaved form so that it cannot go on and effectively infect other cells. You can see the virus there. It's an incomplete virus, but it will not go on and infect other cells. So let me close here by what I've really tried to focus on are some fundamentals that hopefully will help you in your understanding as the next several days go through. I've focused on some of these early events of transmission, the importance of understanding the diagnosis and management of acute HIV, the natural history of untreated HIV, what that looks like, and understanding that it's highly variable. And last, some of the basics about how the different drugs work and how that fits in with understanding the HIV life cycle. So I'll go ahead and close there. Thank you very much.
So, yeah.
So now we have about 15 minutes for questions and answers. We prefer that people come up to the mic and ask a question. No question is a bad question. If you are worried that your question is a bad question or otherwise too shy, we do have cards in the back that people are handing out for questions. Mike, do you want to talk a little bit about the national curriculum? Several people were commenting on how incredibly great your graphics were. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll say a word about the national. I think I'm mic'd down now. Can I get mic'd back up? Or I can
come right here.
I'll switch with you for just a second. Then they can mic me back up. I think they just turned it off when I was done. So several of you are probably familiar with the National HIV Curriculum, but this is a project I've been involved in multiple years, and it's been funded by HRSA, and it's really been a great partnership of sort of this you know, partnership of an educational venue without having to have any pharmaceutical involvement in it. And it's a very extensive, comprehensive curriculum that you can use free, and there's free CME throughout it. And I think if you're interested in it, you can search National HIV Curriculum, Google, and you'll find it very easily. And it's really meant to be for providers at all levels. And there's an antiretroviral section on there for those of you that are teachers where you can download any of the slides. And some of you, if you like the kind of images that I've shown here today, many of these images are in the antiretroviral section. You're free to and happy to have you load them into your own teaching that you're actually using. So, yes. So we got a couple questions here. And let me see if I'm mic back up again. I think not, so I'll still have to share the podium with you here. Great, thank you. I think, Sky, you came up first, so if you want to go ahead. That's great. And I'll go second to you, okay?
I was going to say thank you for, I don't know, is this on too? Thank you for, you know, great, concise talk, as you always give, and the great graphics. But one of the things I see clinically, and I was just going to ask if this is, I don't hear it mentioned much, is that when we use an integrase based regimen, especially in somebody with a very full reservoir, so to speak, I tend to see the blips more often. And, you know, when teaching learners, I often say that we're blocking with your backbone and your anchor. You know, before integration, we still have a reservoir of a lot of proviral DNA. And I tend to see that apparently come out of that reservoir in blips more often, and also when we're starting patients on integrase-based, you know, you have that very rapid viral load decline, but then you see quite a long tail of little blips and a very low-level viremia if they're more well-established. You know, you mentioned that incomplete virus, even with protease inhibitors, but I don't tend to see that in boosted protease inhibitor regimens, and just a clinical observation and seeing if that's something you've seen.
So also, just to keep this, so the basic comment is about integrase inhibitors, and to make one thing that's not controversial at all is the statement about what happens after you start people on integrase inhibitors compared to other regimens. And Mike, if you want to jump in on. Okay, so some of the basic science behind that, Bob Silicano is going to talk about in detail. I will not get into that. But what I will say is back to one of the points that Sky was making is that when you start people on HIV integrase inhibitors, you do get a much more rapid decline in HIV RNA levels than you do with NNRTI-based or protease inhibitor-based regimens, and how that impacts the reservoir, Bob Silicano is going to talk about, and how whether or not that's clinically relevant is another issue. But thanks for that question. That's a good prime for what's going to be talked about in the cure. Yes, please.
Yes, my name is Hermion. I have a question about early infection versus chronic infection. You have someone who has a positive antibody test, has a doesn't have a detectable viral load, and then where's the utility, or how would you get an HIV DNA to determine if that person is actually HIV positive?
Okay, so interesting question. So this is a little bit different than what I'm talking about. We have these weekly echo sessions that we do, and this exact question comes up. So just to summarize, if I understand this correctly, and thank you, sometimes we have people who are antibody positive, and they have an undetectable viral load. And what do you do in that circumstance to really figure out for sure that they have HIV? And as I mentioned, that is a feasible scenario that could happen, especially if you know that one out of 300 people, or these called elite controllers, that they don't have detectable virus around. So what you were mentioning is there is a test that you can do called a proviral DNA or HIV DNA assay. Those are commercially available now, and you can do these, and they're definitely available through different research labs. So that is typically what we do. First thing we usually do is repeat everything again. We do the antigen antibody test, so we make sure that an antigen is in there. We repeat a viral load, and this is all about like a month later or 3 weeks later. And then if they're still with that scenario, antibody positive, viral load negative, and they don't have obvious risk factors especially, then we will go into a proviral DNA. So thank you for that question. Yes.
So we have two other questions. So do elite controllers have the same issues for chronic major diseases like cardiovascular risk? And do we treat pregnant elite controllers?
Oh, good question.
And do we give elite controllers partners PrEP?
Okay, so all three of those are very controversial, and let me just address this as best I can, and I would love to have Mike jump in if he wants to make any comments as well. So if you could pick one thing in HIV that's probably where you would get the most disagreement about, it would be how to manage elite controllers, and it would be the exact same three questions that are getting at here. So first of all, elite controllers have been shown to have an increase in inflammatory markers that are associated with these cardiovascular disease risks and strokes. So they do have an increase in these markers. Clinically, it is hard to know whether or not elite controllers have a marked increase compared to people who are age-matched controls. You can treat them with antiretroviral drugs, and you can show that these inflammatory markers go down. But whether or not there is a long-term clinical benefit in treating all elite controllers is controversial. I would say that most of the field has probably moved more and more towards treating elite controllers in the last 3 to 4 years, especially as our drugs have gotten so good and so safe. So that's my general, and I'm very biased by it. I had one elite controller that had a very aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Burkitt's lymphoma, and almost died. And that influenced me a lot. And whether or not he would have had that if I'd had him on antiretroviral therapy, I don't know. But elite controllers can have complications. Pregnant elite controllers, there is no data on this. And I would say, again, to be completely safe, my own recommendation, given the safety of drugs in pregnancy now, I would probably treat a pregnant elite controller. And the third was partners. Now, that's a really tough one. If you look at all the, and you're going to hear a lot about all of the partner studies and transmission and U equals U. If you go to the U equals U studies, those are people on antiretroviral therapy that didn't transmit to partners, and their threshold that they used in these studies were 200 copies. So you could make a pretty strong argument that if a person is a long-term non-progressor with a viral load of 50 or 60 copies, that they probably are extraordinarily low risk, but I will say it is a different situation. One is a natural situation, and one is a antiretroviral-induced situation. Also, though, there is some data from the Rakai study that showed people who had viral loads under 1,000 essentially didn't transmit. So I think if you're talking about elite controllers, they're probably extremely low risk of transmitting to their partners. But I certainly am not confident to say we shouldn't be giving them. The other thing is you always need to go when you're talking about PrEP, you need to be thinking about what partners are doing with other partners, and that's probably the single biggest thing to think about. Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Good morning. My question is about whether you need to do an HIV viral load when you're monitoring patients on PrEP, If now we have the fourth generation test, which will diagnose acute infection sooner?
So, Mike, I'm sure Rafi's going to talk about this as well, too, right? This will probably get discussed a lot in the PrEP talk, but I'll basically just say this. The standard monitoring in people on PrEP is not viral load testing. It is using fourth-generation antigen antibody testing typically
but
every
do
3 months.
Both?
The antigen antibody, correct. It should have a P24 antigen. A regular third-generation HIV antibody test is not what I would use to monitor people with
so
PrEP.
So we're wasting our money by doing both.
I'm sorry, yes.
We're wasting our money by doing both.
I think so, in my opinion. And I don't know if it's wasting money, but it's certainly not as good as using an antigen antibody assay. Now, if you are following somebody and they're on PrEP and they are developing acute signs and symptoms of acute HIV, they would be very high priority to do a viral load test if they had clinical symptoms of acute HIV.
Someone asked about the advantages of a fifth-generation HIV test.
So the fifth-generation antibody test, I'm not an expert on that, and the person that asked that may know more about this than I do. There is a combination antigen-antibody test that I think they're referring to that's believed to have even better sensitivity, but whoever asked that question, it's an interesting question if they want to come up to the podium or to the microphone and make a further comment about it. I'm not an expert on the fifth generation. Anybody else know? Or is this... Okay, no, yes.
Thank you very much. Your slide on CD4 progression got me thinking about one of my patients. Like most of us, I'd imagine, my patients either take their medicines and do extremely well, or some of them don't take their meds at all, and their viral loads are consistently high. One patient who wouldn't take his meds for a variety of mental health and other reasons has started doing that, and he's gone from high... poor control to excellent virologic control, but his CD4 count dropped pretty low, and it's kind of stuck there, and that's been for a few years now. So he's still doing well, taking Bactrim, and his diabetes is controlled and all that stuff. But do you have any experience or see anything with people eventually getting back once they're down into the range of, like, 90s, or is he probably there for the rest of his life?
Okay, so great question. We talked about different progressions in people, slow, medium, sort of rapid progression. There's also recovery. And recovery is highly variable. And that's extremely difficult to predict. The couple of factors that predict sort of blunted or persistent low CD4 counts are older age, severe concomitant illnesses like cancer, or people on medications that may actually blunt their you know, cell turnover. So older individuals who start antiretroviral are at the highest risk of remaining very low. I will say, though, if you have somebody low, it is really worth continuing to just keep hope and following them along. I've had a number of people who percolated on it at kind of down in that 90-100 range, and then they go up. The good news is if they persistently suppress their virus, they tend to do very well clinically, and I'm sure Steve's going to talk about this more about opportunistic infections and when we can stop prophylaxis.
So along those same lines, why doesn't the gall damage that occurs in early HIV infection recover once HIV is treated?
So great question. So there's several people that are particularly interested in this area, and Danny Duak of the NIH has given a number of talks on this area. And it's somewhat of a mystery why this fallout that occurs very early is not completely recoverable. And I certainly don't know the answer why. I don't think anybody at this point knows the answer why, except to say that there is essentially the whole environment is permanently altered after that big initial fallout of the lymphocytes. But I will say they've done rectal biopsies in these individuals in the first several weeks of HIV. And when you look at these in articles and you look at the histological staining of this, the fallout is really profound very early. And I think it's that it's so significant that, and I don't want to give you the impression that none of it recovers. There is some recovery that occurs, but I think most experts believe that that gut-associated lymphoid tissue never returns to what it would have been if someone had never gotten HIV. But it is a really interesting question, and there's actually a number of people that are trying to do research, whole groups of investigators trying to figure out how to restore that gut-associated lymphoid tissue. So I think we don't understand why it doesn't come back, and we don't understand how to make it come back.
Like the deforestation of Iceland.
Yes.
Desert-like.
Right.
Okay, we have another question up here.
I have a question or a comment or both about elite controllers. I had an elite controller once, and she had rheumatoid arthritis before she was infected. And her rheumatologist eventually put her on one of those wonderful injectable meds, and her T4 count plummeted and her viral load skyrocketed. And I was wondering if you'd had that experience and if, you know, starting her on antivirals before she was started on that med might have made a difference. Have y'all seen that?
So personally, I have not seen that exact scenario. We are going to have a talk. This is great that you brought this up, because there is actually going to be a whole talk on the use of biologics and sort of what we should do with our patients. Let's everybody kind of keep in our mind the case that she just told us about, and I think it'll get addressed in more detail, more systematically. I think you can certainly make an argument that these individuals, the elite controllers who are going to have something happening like chemotherapy, and I'll just address any major severe thing, it would be wise to put them on antiretroviral therapy ahead of time. But I know we're going to get into that in more detail. I will say one issue with the elite controllers that all of you may deal with if you ever have to deal with it. Once you start them on antiretroviral therapy, you essentially don't have anything to follow. They don't have a viral load, and their CD4 counts are high. So you're driving in the dark. It's really tough. So that's one of the reasons that we struggle with what the right thing to do is.
Okay, you have 50 seconds. So could you comment a bit more on the role of neutralizing antibody in acute HIV?
Right, so neutralizing antibodies, I was focused on the cytotoxic T lymphocytes, and there's a whole group of people that spent more than a decade trying to understand what it is that the immune system does that helps HIV to come under control. And Bruce Walker's group in Boston really led this, and they really determined that what happens with the virus being controlled is not so much related to properties of the virus, like whether it's not deleted NEF or anything, but it's more related to the human HLA types and immune response related to cytotoxic T lymphocytes. And there are actually certain specific polymorphisms that are clearly associated with elite controllers. So that's the dominant response. But it is believed that there's also some role of antibodies that come in and actually dampen down the HIV replication as well, too. So the neutralizing antibodies play sort of a supporting role. And it's believed that once they kick in, they play a role in the set point being established as well, too. But the dominant role is from the cytotoxic T lymphocytes.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.